I'd like now to welcome Daniel Dreyfus. He's producer of the Chilean film No, which stars Gael Garcia Bernal, and which was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. It opens at the CCA on Friday, April 5th. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So this is a fictionalized account of the advertising campaign that was part of the strategy to depose Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet in 1988. How did you come across this story, and to what extent is it a true story?
Okay, so I came on board of this project back in 2010. I live in Los Angeles. I'm originally from Brazil. So I met the Chilean producer, Juan, who is the director's brother as well. And so they're both from Chile, come from a political family. I heard of the project and I immediately said, this is something that I have to do. It's a story that I have to tell. It's so timely in the world today, both because there's so many people still striving to have a voice all over the world, as well as because it focuses on the power of media in promoting social change. And today, with all the tools we have at our disposal, that just became an Arab Spring and all these things, it became a very timely issue. How true the story is. So the story is the story of the plebiscite and the 27 days in which the yes and the no confronted each other in television. It's absolutely true. In fact, a third of the film, almost between 25% and a third, is original footage from the campaign of the time. All of that is true. The one thing that is fictionalized is that Gael, it's actually an amalgamation of two people who spearheaded this campaign. And a lot of people in the film represent not only themselves, represent a few people who occupied those positions or fought for those ideals. And not everybody in the film existed as an individual. Obviously, the film also covers and focuses on the power of media and the advertising campaign that was on TV when the Yes and the No fought against each other. It's not an attempt to document all the efforts that were made, which include the door-to-door knocking to register people to vote, as well as, you know, the work of the unions and all the other areas where Chile had been organizing itself. They were also very important to bring down Pinochet. But the campaign, it's absolutely true.
The commercials or the footage that we see of this campaign in the film, No, I love this film. I mean, I thought it was so interesting the way these things were intercut, and it was very seamless. The look of the movie has that kind of old film stock, and it's very much from that era. Are the ads themselves from then, or were they made now for the film?
Well, as I said, about 25% to 30% of the film is original footage. So most of the actual campaign, especially the Yes, is all original footage. It was that bad. They put out a terrible campaign. History served as well in that sense that we had this document, the footage was available. The research department on this film did a fantastic job. Not only we use a lot of the original campaign, sometimes we recreate it, and we have the same people that were in the campaign in 1988 playing themselves in the same setting with the same set and the same circumstances that were intercut between themselves in 1988 and the same individuals saying the same lines today or when we shot in 2011. So you see the same person but older in the same setting. And the fact that all these people were alive and willing to come forward and could be identified, it's truly a privilege. And it just makes the film such a rich, entertaining piece, hopefully, in addition to a historical document in some way. But it's very funny. It's very funny because we take the angle of the point of view of the ad man. So it's not a heavy historical film at all. It, as you saw, there's a lot of humor, there's a lot of irony. Audiences throughout the world, from Japan to Brazil to France, laugh throughout. And it's hopefully educational in addition to being fun.
Well, it's, I think, one of those films that would be really good to see in a movie theater with lots of other people around, because, I mean, it is funny, and the coalition that's trying to get rid of Pinochet hires an advertising guy, and his job, I mean, he's like one of those madmen. His job is to sell soda and soap operas and things like that. And he brings to the campaign this lightness and Chile will be happy again. And this brings up conflicts that have to do both with the boringness of socialist aesthetics and the kind of conflicts between people who want those kinds of aesthetics and people who want something that's more hip and young and so on, but also the deeper issue of how much the horror of Pinochet's regime do you show, do you represent on television while trying to depose him? And it's such an interesting and important question, because I think it's a question that every political campaign in one way or another has to deal with, down to a presidency in the United States or whatever, even if it's not a military dictatorship.
Absolutely. I agree with this 100%. I mean, it has been traditionally an issue on the left, especially, that the situation is portrayed will speak for itself, and you don't have to do anything around it. That's a game that the right plays, or something like that. In this case, showing the reality and just saying these are the horrors of the last 15 years, you decide for yourself, would never work, because the population was already terrorized. The population did not want to come out of their homes to vote. The population, imagine, to have a referendum called by a dictator on his own dictatorship, it's obviously a scam. In their minds, he was going to rig it, he was going to win it, and on top of it, you're going to be perceived as the person who went under a dictatorship to vote against dictators. And also, some people had never voted. They had never seen a ballot. They didn't understand what the process was. It was something that was not organic to that society after so long. So the first work was to get people to register to vote, in addition, as I said, to the TV campaign. But you're absolutely correct in that what the character, René Saavedra, who Gael plays, tried to do was to sell democracy as a product, the same way that he sold the soda commercial, with the same language that he applied to the products, the mass products that he sold from the big companies, which is interesting from a political standpoint, is that he used the very language that was brought by the neoliberal system to sell these big products of the big foreign corporations to defeat the dictatorship that brought them. And I find that irony really interesting. It was always an element that intrigued me about the story.
Yeah, very much so. And it's also when you have this sense of, you know, you've got a guy who's in the first scenes of the movie selling a soda called Free, and people are running around feeling free, and then the ad campaign against Pinochet has the same kind of feeling and aesthetic. This idea that you can use those aesthetics to make people, I mean, you're showing dancers and mimes and people running around and children and flowers and puppies and things like that, that those images make people free enough to get out of the house and vote. That's a profound and interesting and kind of complicated thing.
It is, and it comes to show the power of advertising and mass media in modern society, in contemporary society. He uses some of these elements that you mentioned, the mimes, and this very Americanized language that looks like a big Pepsi Cola commercial, obviously the Free, which is a real commercial, by the way. It is, again, what I mentioned, the language of the foreign oppressive capital, the big corporations, the conglomerates that were brought to Chile during the dictatorship, and then he quote unquote works in the way for the foreign bad guy, but he takes that interest, that language, and applies it to the very audiences they were then going to vote against dictatorship. It's that irony that I find fascinating.
Yeah.
And you figure that in 1988, they only had TV as their major mass medium. Radio was present, but didn't have the power of the image. Today, we have Twitter, We have Instagram, we have Facebook, we have the World Wide Web. I mean, the speed that information circulates, it's unparalleled. And so that is what I wanted to try and convey with the film, is that if people can do all of that under a dictatorship in 1988, what can people do today with right. all the tools at their disposal, when you can click one button on your Twitter and reach thousands, some people, millions of people, as far as sharing ideas or sharing a picture like the pictures from the square during the Arab Spring in Egypt, and how people organize themselves around that square in the political movement using these very tools. So this is a precursor in Chile to what we now see with the Obama campaign and many other campaigns, as you referenced earlier, that use these same tactics.
We're talking to Daniel Dreyfus, producer of the film No. It can take a while for societies that have been through dictatorships to really come to grips with that period in their history and to have the freedom to represent it through art and film and so on. We had here in Santa Fe a few years ago a traveling show of art about the disappeared, which was fantastic. You're from Brazil. You are making this film. What's your perspective on that? I mean, you have this period in history. How long does it take, and what period are we in now in representing Latin America in the 70s and 80s?
That's an interesting question. First and foremost, I lived in a dictatorship until I was about six. It was by no means the heavy years of the dictatorship in Brazil. I was raised in Brazil. But it was a dictatorship, a transitional period, and that it was not a democracy, meaning people did not vote. They did not have the right to choose who was going to be their president. I can tell you my mother, for example, only had the right to vote for the first time when she was 39 years old. So she spent all of her youth and her younger years without ever having a chance to say who her president was going to be. There was no voice in that sense. How societies deal with being able to talk about the horrors or the lack of freedom, I think that you cannot lump South America or Latin American or even South America in one bag. I think different countries, whether it's Argentina or Chile or Brazil, went at their own different paces, and especially in cinema, where you have to factor in the development of these various industries in the decade that followed the democratic transition. Like Brazil had a tragic decade in the 80s for films. Other countries had slightly different historical developments. Chile is one country that has been very vocal about their history, as has Argentina, that has made many movies that touched upon the subject. Chile has had the famous documentaries made. Pablo has already made two films prior to No that became an unintentional trilogy about the dictatorship. Brazil, perhaps a little less. Brazil did not have this history of going back to the late 60s, early 70s, and referencing that time in cinema as much. And I think that each country has a different pace and interest in going back to its own history. And, you know, it has to be organic. Otherwise, you're probably not going to end up with substantial product that talks to people. But Argentina has a lot. They won an Oscar with movies that reference their political years of desaparecidos and violence, and Chile has done really well. So I think it's a very fruitful time for Latin American cinema as a whole. Whether it goes political, I think it's to each time.
Right, right. Another interesting thing about the film No is, I mean, there's so many ways in which it's contemporary, and one of them is you hear Pinochet's people saying virtually the same things that Mitt Romney was saying in his campaign. Like, poor people, they just want handouts. They're a bunch of socialists. And it invites contemplation of what are the real questions, like what are the realities and what's just the rhetoric, and why do we have to go through this sort of canned rhetoric decade after decade instead of actually dealing with the problems at hand?
Well, in the case of Pinochet, it stemmed not from an interest in people's needs. It stemmed from an interest in how to conquer and stay in power.
Right.
So it was never an organic analysis into what do people actually want to need and to subside on and how to improve society and how to definitely not how to empower people. That is the opposite of what they wanted. They were just trying to figure out strategies as to how to get to people to benefit themselves, or at least to benefit their vision of what a better country was, which included killing people of their own. So, you know, when you transpose that to modern society, and I think you're alluding to the unfortunate comment by Romney of the 47%, again, he was speaking, I think if you put that into context, I think he was trying to say that there's half of the population that's not going to vote for me anyways. Let's focus on the ones that are going to vote for me, meaning what strategy do we use to win? And again, you do not take into consideration the very needs of society. You're not talking about what most people in this country need over the next 4 years should I be president. You're talking about what do people need to hear right now so that I can gain power and win, which, you know, to some people, that is what needs to be done. To some people, that would be appalling, and that goes with your political preferences. I think our political opinions in a movie called No are very clear, in case anyone had any doubts on which side of the debate we stood when it came to Chile and the horrors of the dictatorship.
How did you choose Gael García Bernal for this role?
Well, Gael was attached to the project when I came, and I could not think of anybody better. He was one of the elements that attracted me to the film, obviously in addition to a story that I needed to tell. He is one of the very few artists from Latin America that transcends Latin America. He is part of what I envisioned, that the film could be bigger than Chile. The film could be bigger than South America and its native, obvious art house audience. We could go beyond that. And it's only if we were able to succeed in that the message of the movie would carry through and fulfill its potential. So it's only when people in remote places look and say, I know nothing about Chile or Pinochet, but I'm watching these people and I'm watching Gael play this character and I'm inspired. That's when it would work. I didn't want people that knew everything about it, and you know, the very few people that know everything about it, only because then you're preaching to the choir. Right. And as I said, I believe that the film has a social function. But also, Gael is one of the greatest actors in the world in his age range, for sure. He's a very political individual in his own personal life, so he was very drawn to the role. And in the movie, he plays somebody that has been exiled, that has been outside of Chile for a long time, and he receives a lot of criticism from the party, as you indicated earlier, not only because he wants to bring a vision that is selling rainbows and, you know, French baguette and elements that are not perceived to be very Chilean, but in addition, he has been out of the country for a really long time. And so we play a little bit with this element that he is from Mexico and his accent and the fact that in one scene he's wearing a Mexico World Cup t-shirt to bring this into the story, into the narrative, that he is somebody that has been out of the country for a while. And so you can question, how much about this country and our reality do you really know?
Right, right. Now, this film has been shown all over the world. What kinds of responses has it gotten in different parts of the world, particularly where there have been political upheavals?
You know, that is the beauty of the film. My main concern was to make a movie, as I said, that would play to people that were aware and to people that were not aware of the dictatorship. So when I took the film to Tokyo for the Tokyo Film Festival, people came to me with tears in their eyes saying how much the story inspired them. And honestly, that's why I think we make movies, is to touch people and bring them bring them on a journey and expose something that, if it wasn't for film, a historical true story where many people suffered and this freedom was won, even though they may know nothing about it. So film has that power. Obviously, it rings different in societies where you have audiences that went through similar processes. The film is doing now, right now really well in France, another country that, while it had a very rich political history, distant but didn't have recent, in the 20th century, didn't have dictatorships, but had wars, but it didn't have a traditional coup d'etat. And so when you have a film play in Argentina or in Chile or in Brazil or in many other places, you obviously get a different level of response from some people, not from everybody. But it's a very interesting added layer. In Chile, it was a polemical film, right? You have people who are very moved. You have people that oppose the movie. You have people that to this day are probably Pinochet sympathizers. You have people that were the kids, the mothers, the brothers of people that disappeared in the same audience. You have people that either are on the left and criticize the film because, again, it's focused on the ad campaign and not on everything else that was going on contributing to the no, right. Which is fair from a historical standpoint, but unfair in my view from a cinematic standpoint, because we took a specific angle. We had a point of view, and we could have covered everything, but it would have been a flawed film. It would have been perhaps a very historical document, but a flawed piece of cinema, and that was not our intention. Our intention was to make a great film, a fun film, and hopefully an important film. But you can only do that with a film that hopefully it's good. So it does play very different in different places in the world, and you have positions such as people from the right who probably responded positive, very few people on the left that actually responded negatively. You have a lot of people in L.A. that came, you know, we screened at the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles. There were, you know, the grandkids of Holocaust survivors. There were more people that disappeared during that time. There were people from Chile that lost relatives. I had somebody once stand up in one of the Q&As and say they voted yes. A woman was the only person in all of this process that I ever had who had the courage to say that, and then it led to a very interesting conversation in the room. But the beauty is to see how it moves people everywhere. And we have been very fortunate. You know, the film has gone to so many places. I didn't even follow the film everywhere, but it went to places that I didn't go. But the film went to London and Turkey and Greece, festivals, in addition to runs in the theaters. But I went to Tokyo, I went to São Paulo, New York, Cannes, Toronto, Columbia, Missouri, many places. And there's always a very visceral response to the film, which is that idea that there is a universality in its theme. And that's what I think matters the most.
The film is called No. It opens at the CCA here in Santa Fe this Friday, the 5th of April. Daniel Dreyfus is the producer. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure. I hope you enjoy the movie and that it leads to lots of rich conversations after.
Very much so. I'd like now to welcome Pasha Hogan. She's the author of the new book, Third Time Lucky, A Creative Recovery. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
And by the way, Pasha will be speaking at the ARC Bookstore this Saturday at 3 o'clock right here in Santa Fe. So this is a book about your recovery from having breast cancer three times in a row when you were a young woman, starting at the age of 26. And at the very beginning of the book, there is a quote from the doctor, Larry Dossey, who said that he did not understand why patients would sometimes say to him, cancer is the best thing that ever happened to me. I read that and I would think the same thing. Do you feel that way?
You know, I think luck is a word that we use in retrospect. So when something happens, Of course not. Like, yay, I have a third cancer diagnosis. This is fantastic. Definitely not. You know, it's devastation. It's not wanting it to be that way. It's getting angry. All of these different emotions. But in my own experience, getting cancer the third time was a real turning point for me in my life. And I feel that I was lucky because I learned how to live all over again.
So you were doing this thing. You were living in Europe. You were living in England and Ireland at that time in your life. And you were doing a kind of climbing the corporate ladder. And it sounds like you were kind of having a lot of fun while you were doing it. And the first two times that you were diagnosed with breast cancer, your attitude was kind of like, okay, let's take care of this and let's keep going. And there's a scene where you're in your hospital bed surrounded by files, doing your work even through this. And then the third time, something different happened.
Yeah, the first two times I tried to outrun it, and I thought it was something that wasn't supposed to be happening. And I just wanted to get back to normal as quickly as possible. And I did. And, you know, looked fine during it most of the time. I didn't lose my hair when I had chemotherapy the first time. It was milder. And so I never looked like I had cancer. And I didn't want to look like I had cancer, of course.
And who does?
Right, of course. And just kept moving. And it was very fast-paced in alignment with my life at the time. But the third time, I guess my questions changed. Because the first time, it was, oh, what do I tell my mother? I was 26 years old. The second time, I was 29. And I thought, oh, my God, what am I going to tell my boss? I had just got a new job, a new promotion. And the third time, the question was, how long do I have to live?
Right.
And a question like that will stop you in your tracks. And I'm glad that it did. Because I realized my life was wildly out of balance. What it looked like on the outside and how I was feeling about it on the inside weren't in alignment. And the third time was an opportunity to ask some questions.
And so how did those questions and the answering of them and the contemplation of them change the way you moved forward?
Mm. Well, everyone kept telling me that I was great at my job. And I thought, wow, I can't stand my job. I do not like what I'm doing at all. And I thought, wow, well, what if I actually did something I even liked a little bit? You know, what could my life be like then? So I started asking questions like, well, what makes my heart sing?
Well, before that, you had already started asking those questions, and you said, well, instead of doing sort of corporate reinsurance, I could do public relations, and you took a public relations course and found that it was basically taking something empty and making it look good, which wasn't really fulfilling either.
Right. And it's really interesting. I didn't realize that that is what was going on in my own life. You know, just trying to fix it up from the outside. So really, I guess the third time for me was self-inquiry, was really looking at my own value system, beliefs that I held, feeling like I wasn't good enough, dealing with self-esteem and all kinds of issues like that. So it was pausing and taking a look at the stories of my life.
And getting out of that kind of work into a new kind of work.
Right. And that was a huge part of it. I started becoming interested in, I guess, therapy, which was like public relations from the inside out, and studied to be a psychotherapist. And even during all of that and all this endless self-inquiry and group therapy, and which was exhausting and helpful but exhausting, I thought, you know, there's got to be more to it than words and just constantly searching and digging. So that's when creativity started and playfulness started to come in more. And learning how to be softer with myself, get off my back, take time out, and just turning down the volume of the inner critic that would stop me when I thought, oh, this is fun, I shouldn't be doing it, or I should be doing something more productive, or something more serious.
Right. You watched Oprah when you needed to.
Absolutely.
So, meanwhile, you also did surgery, radiation, and hardcore chemotherapy. I mean, it wasn't like you just decided you were going to eat bean sprouts or...
Yeah, absolutely not. It was an aggressive cancer the third time, so we treated it very aggressively. So I went down the road of chemotherapy and losing my hair, and I had a full mastectomy that time as well. I wanted to get it out of my body. It was a choice that I made, a very personal choice. And I realized I did not have the skills to visualize it away, wish it away, change my diet, and that would be enough. So I did all of it.
Right.
Actually.
As I understand it, that's not enough for everybody. I mean, nobody can visualize away their cancer.
You know, there are lots of books written and that people do. It has not been my experience or anybody that I have known who has been able to do something like that. People make all kinds of choices when they're confronted with life-threatening diseases.
Yeah. What do you recommend to people? I mean, what do you do when people come to you, they've just been diagnosed with cancer recently, and they say, well, I just want to make it go away through right living?
Well, I'm not a medical practitioner, for starters, so I'm not in the habit of giving medical advice to people. But what I do suggest is that they talk, of course they want it to go away, right? But really to talk to their doctor and to find out what their options are, to empower themselves with information, all different kinds of treatments that are available, because that's only one way. And, you know, I don't know if it's the most effective way, personally.
Right, right. Now, we're talking to Pasha Hogan about her book, Third Time Lucky, A Creative Recovery. So you went through this path that involved a lot of artistic creativity and kind of introspection and psychotherapeutic ways of working with yourself, and now you do that for others. Mm-hmm. Tell us about that whole process, and especially for people who are very sick, whether it be cancer or working with people with other illnesses or with addictions.
Yeah, it was a huge... Well, cancer was a catalyst for change in my life. And I realized the change had to come from within. You know, how I thought about myself, how I viewed myself. So now I work with... I call it creative recovery. And it's really... It's a strong spiritual focus. And by spiritual, I don't mean religious in any way. Spirituality to me is really the difficult and sometimes painful work of learning how to love ourselves. And I think that's where any kind of recovery or healing starts. So it's through this process, engaging in, you know, mindfulness techniques, learning meditation, through stories, through myth, through our collective stories, knowing that we're not walking this path alone, you know, and uncovering our own stories and beliefs, limiting beliefs that keep us stuck feeling not good enough or not creative enough, or flexible enough, or whatever it is. And I know those storylines because I've been carrying them around for a very long time, and I know how intimidating it can be to pick up a paintbrush or roll out a yoga mat or sit on a meditation cushion. So it's entering through wherever the person is, you know, not having to get to someplace else, entering wherever you are, and in a playful way, and softening the inner critic way, learning how to do those things so you can connect with the joy inside. You know?
And those are things that are very helpful when people are going through these really awful cancer treatments like chemotherapy and radiation and recovering from surgery. And they're also helpful after that process is done.
Absolutely. And this is what I found a lot of the time is that after treatment was over for people, it was like, well, what's next? You know, what do I do with my life now? And
besides wait for the next scan to see that I'm still okay.
Right, exactly. Which, you know, people can get very much, and understandably, you know, it's a scary thing. But to have a strong boundary around that, like, okay, I am looking after myself. I know when my next checkup is going to be, having a boundary around it so you don't spend then, you can spend the rest of your time living, you know, living into life. And a lot of time has been spent, I notice, with people wanting to get back to normal. So I think it's a time for saying, well, what if there's nothing to get back to, you know, about creating a life that you're longing, that you're yearning to live, and how to move into that, and engaging in some of these practices can help loosen up some of the limited thinking that we have about how we're supposed to live.
I think there's so many different kinds of limiting thinking. Like, one of them is if you grew up in a household where you were supposed to be this or that kind of person. Let's say you were supposed to go into your parents' business or whatever, go down a certain career path or get married and have two kids or whatever. Mm-hmm. But then there's also other kinds of limiting beliefs in supposedly liberated circles. And one of them that personally drives me crazy is the idea that your illness is your own fault or your own creation. I mean, as far as I can see it, and I'd love your perspective on this, but as far as I can see it, the reality is we actually don't know where a lot of illnesses come from. Medical science doesn't know, psychologists don't know, Zen masters don't know.
You know, I'm glad you bring that up. When I was diagnosed first, it was coming across books like this all the time. Like, oh, well, if you have this kind of cancer, it's because you're holding anger. If you
right.
have this kind of cancer, it's because you're holding grief. And it used to drive me crazy. And I think it puts a lot of the onus on the person, like, oh, this is my fault. I've
exactly.
done this to myself. And I don't think that's helpful in any way at all.
Neither helpful nor true.
Mm-hmm. But what I think we can do is to participate in our own lives. Right, to take responsibility for our own lives and to get to know things that make us sad, make us stressed out, contribute to our stress. Because there are lots of studies done that, you know, prove that, yes, stress is a huge factor on our immune system. And when we can help reduce this cortisol and these levels, that things run smoother, you know. So I think by being happier, by knowing our minds, controlling our thoughts, being mindful of what we put in our bodies, laughing, having fun,
right.
you know, being joyful, not worrying about every single thing we're putting into our bodies, but, you know, making conscious choices. So it's raising awareness, I think, is really important rather than putting blame.
And may I add to that list, having a dog? Or a cat,
whatever it is that brings more joy into your life. You know, and that's what a lot of creative recovery is about, you know. It's not just about, oh, when something happens, then I'll start looking. I tell a lot of personal stories, which I think are universal stories, looking at things like sexuality, body image, self-esteem, and saying, okay, let me be responsible for what I'm thinking about myself.
Right. And, you know, there's an interesting story in your book about how, I mean, you'd had a mastectomy, so you had one breast, and you finally decided to tell a man about this who was your pal, and he reacted very differently than what you thought, and he was so compassionate. And I think one of the things that I took away from that is this whole body image thing, you really don't know how people are reacting mm-hmm. to you, mm-hmm. and a lot of what they see in you or anybody is that person's beautiful or not so beautiful spirit, not the shape of some little part of their body.
It's so true. I mean, mostly what I found with people is just how kind people are, you know, when it comes to other people, right? And we usually have no problem being compassionate to the person opposite us or next to us telling us something. But we're our own worst critics.
Exactly.
We're so hard on ourselves. And just exposing that goes a long way towards helping us soften, you know, and open our hearts to accept ourselves more, too.
The book is called Third Time Lucky, A Creative Recovery by Pasha Hogan, and you will be speaking this weekend, Saturday at 3 o'clock at the ARC Bookstore.
Yes, I will. I love the ARC, and they're hosting the book. It's in other bookstores in town, too, and on Amazon and on my website.
And the website is PashaHogan.com, P-A-S-H-A. Pasha, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. I love your show. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I'd like now to welcome back to the program Ben Swan. He is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society. Welcome.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. Thank you for having us on.
Feels like it's been a while since we've been here talking about animals, although it's probably just been a few weeks. But there's been a really big event, namely a hoarding situation was found and suddenly the Santa Fe Animal Shelter has, what, 50 new dogs?
About 48, actually. It happened essentially overnight. We did have a little bit of a heads up about it, and so the night before, we were able to open up some space by working with some community partners, Santa Fe Tails Dog Daycare and also Braemar Kennels. They took in some animals, and in fact, the night before, I took over a handful over to Santa Fe Tails, and the next day, because we didn't know how many animals we would get. We heard some, maybe 20, and in the end it was 50, 48 dogs and puppies.
For those who've never heard of hoarding, what is animal hoarding?
Well, it's truly a mental illness. People have, they may have the best intentions at heart, but as a mental illness, they don't understand when too much is too much, when they can't handle it. It's not just animals. It can be a lot of different things that you obsessive compulsive just collect these things, and all of a sudden, your house may be full of newspapers or kittens or dogs. And in this case, according to the news reports, it was a lot of dogs.
And so these dogs now are at the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, and we don't yet know what their fate will be.
We don't. They are in basically legal limbo. We have to hold them contractually. They are what they consider evidence. We're hoping the best case scenario is that the woman would relinquish the animals so we can do what we do best, which is to spay and neuter the animals, treat them if they have some really serious issues, and get them adopted.
So meanwhile, you've got 48 extra dogs, which puts a tremendous strain on your staff and kennels and resources and everything else.
That's right, Mary Charlotte. We're bracing for the unknown. So essentially, we may have these, like the roosters that we held for almost 18 months.
Good heavens.
In the legal system. So we're hoping that won't happen. We're hoping that this will resolve itself quickly, that we'll be able to work with these animals. Because that's what we do. That's what we want to do. We want to be able to process these animals, get them out to homes. Now, some of them might not make it. They have a variety of issues. Some have neurological problems, and others have some wounds and injuries. Most of them are shy, timid, and really frightened of the situation that they put in.
Yeah.
Any shelter animal takes a little bit to adjust to things. They don't know something new. But we work really hard in bringing these animals around. And a lot of these, they're mostly healer mixes. There's some older ones. There's a Dalmatian, things like that. We hope to be able to work with these and get them out. So what we're really wanting right now is to asking people if they're thinking about considering adopting an animal. We have plenty of animals to adopt.
Not these, but your regular animals.
Our regular wonderful animals are ready to adopt. And if people are on the fence about it, we'll work with them. Really, we want to find new homes for animals so we can free up more space. And also we're asking the public, if they can just hold off on relinquishing an animal, if there's an issue or something with the animal that they say, this is not working out, we'll work with those people.
Yeah.
Our behavior department will work with those people to make sure that the relationship actually works. And if it doesn't work, we understand that. We'll accept them, but hopefully not for a few days.
So you're also looking for donations of dog food, money, anything that people can give?
Right. As you know, this is, we went from, I know we had 70 animals, now we have 130 in the one rebuilding alone. And so naturally, we had to move these animals out. And it just puts a tremendous stress on our volunteers, our staff, on everyone.
Yeah.
And from everything from staff time to dog food. And we're asking for donations of canned dog food, which is really something we can store and keep for a while, blankets, towels, and also financial donations, just so we can work with these animals and get them adopted.
Meanwhile, you've been doing this work for long enough that you've seen various hoarding situations. Is there a pattern to what the animals are like, what the dogs are like when they come in from a hoarding situation?
It really varies. It depends on how, when the authorities can come in and get them. We try to always jump in before it becomes a situation where we all of a sudden have to have 50 animals. And recently we worked with a woman who had two mini cats, and she realized she had a problem. And we worked with her. We were able to go in there. We were able to take the animals out slowly and not burden the shelter as much as this case is doing. There's really no pattern. There is a pattern where people, generally hoarders, are much like hermits. They kind of hide what they're doing, and people, they don't really let people inside the house. Your neighbors might hear a lot of barking, or depending on what it is. And those are some clues that something not right is going on. You know, in the county, we have people, there's a limit to animals. People can have 10 dogs and cats. And the reason for that is because anything after that is considered a kennel or a boarding facility and should be inspected. And that's really how it should be, because, you know, you want to have animals who are healthy and safe and have enough place to move around, to exercise and things like that. You want to make sure, our goal is to make sure there's healthy animals, and that's what we want everybody else to do as well.
So one of the things that you have besides, that people can do besides make donations and so on, and volunteer, which is another thing people can do, go to the, now you have a couple of resale stores, secondhand clothing and wonderful objects. And there's a new one right across the street from the Santa Fe Baking Company.
That's right. That's Look What the Cat Dragged In 2. It's at 541 West Cordova. And both of these places, the one here on West Cordova and the one on Camino Entrada, 2570 Camino Entrada, are places where people can donate things and also support the shelter by donating their gently used clothing, furniture, books, and also buying wonderful things. And the store right across the street, we have some wonderful people who are running it, Madeline and Madison. And it's
Madeline and Madison.
Yeah, isn't that the two M's? M&M. So it's a great store, and it's just opened 2 weeks ago. We haven't even had a grand opening yet, but we are planning next month to have the grand opening. But anyway,
these resale stores have fabulous clothes. I bought a jacket the other day, and it was beautiful.
And you're wearing it now, and it's beautiful. And this shirt is a Japanese style shirt, and I also got it at the Cat.
Yes, it's very, ladies and gentlemen, it's very elegant.
It's quite elegant.
Let's talk about some of the animals that you have available for adoption.
Right. We have wonderful animals available for adoption. I brought a couple in, but people can go to our website and look. And we also have mobile adoption events at Petco and PetSmart, and other places. But Poncho.
We're talking, by the way, to Ben Swan from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, who just handed me a photograph, a really nicely done photograph, of a beautiful little brown-eyed chihuahua named Poncho.
Poncho is a great dog. You know, we just have some wonderful animals, as I mentioned, and if people are considering adopting, this is the great time to do it. We do have a special going on. There's a reduced price for all animals over a year old, for all dogs over a year old. So this is just a great time. And the weather is turning nicely, so it's a great time to get a dog and just get out and lose a few pounds by walking them
every
day.
It is a great time to get a dog. I got my puppy. Oh, no, I got him in the fall. But anyway, when the weather's nice, it's always a good time to get a dog. But when you can take him outside.
Exactly, and get him used to just going outside to relieving themselves and things
right.
like that. My dogs, if it rains, they'll look out the window and say, I'm sorry, stop the rain.
And we say, no, we need the rain.
Let's go. Yeah. So I also brought in a photo of Lady Godiva. Lady Godiva is a very elegant cat. She's the adoption counselor called a prima donna. She is a three-legged tripod, is what we call them.
Okay.
But she's very particular about her people and her friends. But she's perfect baby for an older person who just wants to lavish all the attention on one animal.
She's very elegant.
She's quite elegant. Yeah.
So and so many more animals are also available. And so basically, if people say, I've been thinking about adopting a puppy or a full-grown dog, this is a great time to do it, because then it makes more room and relieves the pressure for all of these hoarded dogs who have just come in.
Exactly. We have a very minimum standards of care that we really want to make sure all of our animals are mentally healthy and happy. And that's what we're striving to do. And if we have too many animals, we have to double them up, and that might not be ideal. And that's why we just want people to encourage people to come in and check out the animals and adopt and fall in love.
Ben Swan is with the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, that is on the web at sfhumanesociety.org. And the phone number is
983-4309, extension 601 or 610 for adoptions.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure seeing you.